out session number 12578. This is reel 2.
Mr. Hall, reel 2.
Okay, run by this experimental flying unit, run by a guy called Chamberlain, who I think was a wing commander, and the man I dealt with was his number 2 squadron leader, Hiscox, or something like that. Anyway, I said, we want to fly this plenum at, I don't know, let's say 7, 14, and 21,000 feet at a range of 20 miles or whatever, you see. constant range of 20 miles from the station. So I went over there and with my little oscillator, stored it in the aeroplane, and it was a very old, crummy aeroplane, and I noticed where I was going to have to sit. There was an observer's hole to look downwards where they put a camera, but the perspex cover for that was all broken, so there was just a hole about a foot or 18 inches in diameter, and I was to sit by this, looking after my little oscillator. But when we were due to take off, I noticed that everybody was donning massive amount of clothing and silk underwear, silk socks and woolen this, that and the other, and great leather jackets. I was just in a sports coat and flannels. And they said, aren't you going to get dressed? I said, well, I haven't got anything to get dressed in. Well, why do I want to get dressed? They said, it will be very cold. Anyway, they lent me one or two things, but it certainly was the coldest I've ever experienced. And we had a tremendous struggle in this aeroplane to get high enough. I learned afterwards that we were right at the maximum height of this aeroplane, and after some time the pilot said to me, do you mind if we don't quite get to 21,000 feet or may have been 23, I can't remember. And I said, I couldn't care a damn, because I'm practically frozen to death, and never having flown before, and all that decompression, and I was in a terrible state, on oxygen of course all the time. And I said, I didn't mind when we got to 23,000. If we just altered it to 21, that'll be fine by me. But we had all gone through hell to try and get there just for this. Anyway, we did that two or three times. And the last time I remember we did it, he said, do you mind if we come down there? There looks to be a squadron of single-engine aeroplanes above. And I'm not certain whether they are ME-109s or Spitfires. So I said, don't mind in the least if we come down in those circumstances. And we came down very fast indeed, hopping from one bit of cloud to another bit of cloud, which didn't do me any good at all either. So my first attempts at flying were not... Well, my first flying was not very enjoyable, but really quite an experience. So after that, we decided there must be better ways of calibrating this radar. And so we got a balloon on a long cable. It wasn't one of the it was like a barrage balloon, only smaller. And the idea of this was, we'd let this up into the sky at say a mile or two radius, and we would then measure its height with a theodolite, and we'd know how high it was with a theodolite. We'd know its range, and we would measure it on the radar as well. So that was fine. It worked very, very well. It seemed to me that I was about the only person that could work a theodolite, so I worked the theodolite. One day we were doing this, and I suddenly thought to myself, this is wrong. By a very quick calculation, the thing was higher than we had wire for. And indeed, the balloon was flying away, carrying underneath it this precious oscillator, broadcasting to the world the frequency of which our radar stations were on. And drifting gently across the channel towards the enemy coast. Well, we hastily rang up Tangmere, the nearest fighter station, and said, get a fighter in the air and try and shoot this damn thing down, which they did. At least they got a fighter in the air. And I can remember just shows you how difficult controlling aeroplanes is, because at one point we could see the balloon, we could see the fighter, and we just could not get the fighter to see the balloon, and we failed to shoot it down. So with this charging off towards enemy territory, I thought I'd better inform the authorities. And I did all that, the police and the local army command and everybody. And I also informed my bosses back at Swanage, at Werthford Travers, who said to me immediately, go back to them, go back to them. I thought, well, this is the end of my career, this lot, you know. It's the trenches for me from now on. However, when I got there, I reported what had happened, and they just said nothing and sent me back. When I got back, I said I couldn't understand it to the wing commander, who was, or squadron leader, who was the boss Air Force guy there. He said, oh, we've got it back, don't worry. And we let your boss know we got it back, so there was no problem. So how did we get it back? What happened? He said, well, the wind changed, and we had a report that a mysterious object had landed near Horsham. Now, at that time, the Germans were dropping all sorts of mysterious delayed action mines and booby trap things. And so he said, I told them to that this was a very dangerous, likely to be a very dangerous device that the Germans had dropped, and I would come immediately and see to it. So he said, when I got there, there was a crowd, but all at a respectable distance from it. And I crawled gently on my hands and knees and unscrewed something on it and said, it'll now be safe. So that's how security was maintained. Anyway, they were the stories of...
this is in the winter of 1941.
That's right, yeah, that's right. That's how security is maintained during that winter. Well, then that was November. No, yes, winter 40-41. Now, in March 41, I went to another one of these sites, these GCI sites, at Sopley, which is just behind Cambridge. Not Cambridge, Christchurch. Near Bournemouth, and that was a similar site. We were really getting quite sophisticated then, and we had things pretty well under control. And I was there, really didn't stay there terribly long, just to sort of see that everything was well and all was working properly, and that the Air Force were doing what they were supposed to do and all that. In June 41, I went to another one at Sturminster Marshall near Wimborne. Nothing very remarkable had happened at Sopley, except it was a nice place to be. It was near Bournemouth, and we had a fairly routine sort of time.
Are these sites absolutely identical?
They were identical at that time, yes. Those two were identical. But then, at Sturminster Marshall, another guy and myself, we instituted some various improvements on the original one. This was the original GCI stations had a transmitting aerial and a receiving aerial, and one man in each turning handles which turned the whole aerial one way or the other way, and special devices to ensure that when one man turned, the other followed him. There was a sort of servo following arrangement, little indicators which showed which way they were pointing, and when one moved, the other one followed him. That was an electronic following things. Now at Stemminster Marshall, instead of these, what they were called binders, these guys, because they were binding backwards and forwards at the beck and call of the the controller, we installed the first one in which the aerial was driven round and round, and we did that with a bicycle wheel and some old belts and things and electric motor we bought, and we got them going round and round, and that made for a much better display and everything for the controller. He didn't have to sort of tell them to search. It was going round and round, and it was displayed on what they called a PPI, a plan position indicator. I think the first plan position indicators, which are totally common later in the war and now, of course, I think they were probably on these first these early radar stations, GCI stations. The other guy still had to follow, of course. He had to follow the one that was being driven round and round. But there was nothing particularly exciting happened there, except for those technical developments. But before that, I beg your pardon, before that, we had another development, which we did at Langtoft, which is up in Yorkshire somewhere, I think. And I went up there, where we had that was the first station with a much bigger aerial and with what they called a common TNR, the same aerial for transmitting and receiving. This caused a lot of difficulties. Well, we didn't design it, but it was designed back at Morven, back at Worth for Travers, and we were, my friend, fellow called Roland Lees had been the designer, and he came up there and I helped him install this common TNR system. And that worked very well eventually, but it caused a lot of problems at the time. There was an experimental one with similar equipment at RE at Farnborough. I don't quite know why that was there. But I do remember one day at Langtoft when we were broken down, and I said to the station commander of the local Air Force fighters that we would be off the air that night because we hadn't got a spare for this thing. He said, "Well, where can you get one?" And I said, "Well, the only one I know of is at Farnborough on an installation there." And he said, "Right, I'll get an aeroplane, you come with me and we'll go and get it." So I remember we took off from, can't remember which airfield it was up there now, and we flew down to Farnborough. He hardly got out of the aeroplane. I got out of the aeroplane, ran across to this station there, nicked the piece of equipment, got back in the aeroplane, took off back for Langtoft, installed it, and we were on the air that night. Now, I'm sure if there was any paperwork, it never actually caught up with us. But I did have one strange experience while we were up there, and that is that one night there was a night fighter flying, and I recognised the voice. He was a close school friend of mine, and I said, "Is that Alan Picknett, squadron leader Alan Picknett?" He said, "Yes." And I said, he was night fighting with bow fighters by then. And I remember saying to him, "Have you shot down a German yet? Have you got it?" And he said, "Nope, haven't done anything yet." I said, "Well, right, tonight's your night." And we were very naughty because I can remember the commanding officer of the squadron was flying, and Alan was flying, and we concentrated on Alan totally, and left the squadron commander sort of circling, orbiting somewhere. And eventually we got this school buddy of mine his first German. And I can tell you, we had quite a party that following night at his mess. But that was really a remarkable coincidence. And we saw the aircraft come down. Anyway, by the end of 1941, the night fighting was getting fairly standardized. And at the end of 41 or the beginning of 42, sometime round about then, I left all that work and I joined the Radio Countermeasures Group, which was led by a guy called Dr. Robert Coburn, now Sir Robert Coburn. He's almost exactly 10 years older than me, by the way. And it was, I think, round about that time, but that as a result of the Brunval raid, I suppose it was as a result of the Brunval raid, we all moved from Worth Travers to Malvern. And the Brunval raid, I'm sure Bob Coburn has told you, that we all believed anyway that that was the result of pressure from on high to do something about jamming the Würzburg radar, and Bob saying, well, we could do it more easily if we had bits of it. And so the Brunval raid was sent out, which was the first commando raid of the war, went and collected bits, and we had those bits back in Bob Coburn's lab to try and find ways of jamming it.
Do you remember the arrival of the parts?
I can remember the parts. I can't remember the actual act of their arrival. But I was certainly working for Bob then, and they came.
Did they surprise you?
Yes, they well, two things. I certainly, and I think all of us, were surprised at the very high quality engineering, which was much better than ours. At least we thought it was. The parts gave us the impression that they'd been well engineered over a long period and designed for production, I won't say mass production, but sensible production and reliability. Whereas looking at our equipment, you could say it looked as though it had been designed in a great hurry and were not likely to be so easily produced and was likely to be less reliable. Whether that was the case or not, I don't know. But for instance, whereas we had bits of bent tin for chassis, they usually mostly use die-cast aluminium alloy. They had some very good valves as well. That meant a move to Malvern and radio countermeasures.
Presumably, because if we could mount such a raid, the Germans could do the same.
I always felt that was the reason we moved. Of course, I mean what's called TRE, or I think we were AMRE by then, Air Ministry Research Establishment. You see, it started before the war at Bordsey on the East Coast. When war broke out, they were moved to Dundee because it was considered that the East Coast was a bit too near the action. So they were moved to Dundee. Then, of course, the Germans invaded Norway and they decided that was a bit too near the action up there. So they hastily moved down to Worth Travers, which was as far away as they could possibly be. And the Germans moved in across the channel. So after the Brunval raid, I gather people thought that there could be a retaliatory raid on Worth Travers very easily. So we went to the centre of England, to Malvern.
According to Hanbury Brown's book, he says that the moves from one place to another were chaotic and badly administered.
I don't know that. I remember the move from Worth Matravers to Malvern was carried out while I was away at Durring, while I was away on one of these stations. So I don't know where I was. I remember leaving Swanage and after a week or two going back to Malvern. And as far as I was concerned, it all seemed very smooth. I mean, maybe to people much more senior to me, it was chaotic. But to the sort of likes of me down the chain, it all looked all right. It all looked, we seemed to just sort of start work again in a different place. And that was okay. It may have been. I would question what Hanbury Brown says. Actually, I think on that, it may have been chaotic for some people. It was a tremendous task. Remember, they had to throw out Malvern College. There's a friend of mine up here was at Malvern College at the time, and they were terribly upset. They had to get out of the college, go. They had to find digs for all of us. They had to convert classrooms into laboratories. It was a tremendous operation.
It might be that he had the early moves more in mind before.
Maybe the early ones. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. So I wasn't involved in those. But it certainly had a strange history of moving about. Now, radio countermeasures were... the early part of radio countermeasures, which I had nothing to do with, of course, but Bob Coburn have told you all about the jamming of the bombing beams, which he was very much involved in. But when I came in, we were concerned with two aspects of radio countermeasures, really. One, the straight jamming of radio communications, enemy radio communications, and enemy radar. And the other one was what we called spoof activities. And this is sort of pretending to do what we weren't doing. Now, I work for Martin Ryle, who reported to Bob Coburn. Now, Martin Ryle was the guy who, after the war, started radio astronomy at Cambridge, whereas Lovell started radio astronomy, as you know, at Manchester. Now, Ryle was a very anti-publicity man. He didn't want publicity. He wanted to get on with his, you know, he was a scientist. And he was a low-profile person, except when it came to his own science, and he was a very tough character. And I don't know, I wasn't involved at all, but I've always been interested because I was terribly loyal to Martin. Both, of course, Martin Ryle and Bernard Lovell did terribly well, marvellously, and they put this country on the map in radio astronomy. And it was interesting that Martin became a Fellow of the Royal Society before Lovell, but Lovell got his knighthood before Martin. I mean, they both got knighthoods and fellowships of the Royal Society, but in opposite ways round, which I think was probably right. Anyway, Martin was a very brilliant man, and he led us to do some very clever things. He was very good at analysing the signals from the enemy and deciding on the best way of jamming. And then it was our job, those that worked for him, to try and implement the ideas that he had. Well, one of the problems by this we're beginning to have, there were beginning to be fighter sweeps, British fighter sweeps over France. We were becoming stronger and stronger then with our fighters. And they were doing sweeps over France in order to engage the enemy. And also to so that bombers could then go in and bombers or fighter bombers go in and strafe things and all that sort of stuff. And so we wanted to be able to spoof the enemy radar by so the Martins are, if we could put one or two aeroplanes in the air which look like three or four squadrons of aircraft, then that technique could be used to great advantage. Even if the enemy found out we were doing this, they would never know whether we were or not. And so when they saw on their radar 100 aircraft approaching, even if they knew that sometimes these would be entirely spurious, it would only be one or two aeroplanes, they couldn't risk it being that. They'd have to get their fighters up in the air and into position. And so the idea was to develop such a device. And I was involved very much in that. And we decided that, it was decided that there was quite a few old Defiant aircraft which were now useless. I mean, they Defiant aircraft was a single engine aircraft with a gun turret in the rear, two a crew of pilot and a gun turret operator. And we decided that these were, you know, faster than the twin engine things and would look more realistic because of their speed, even though they were somewhat slow compared with the real fighters. And there was room to install in the place where the gun turret was all our equipment. Now, the problem was how to test these things after we designed it. So we decided that we'd test this. To do this up in Scotland, where we converted one of our own 200 megacycle radar transmitters to the frequency the Germans use, which was around about 120 megacycles. That conversion was done for us by RAE, and we installed that up at an airfield near Edinburgh called Drem. And it's relatively short range, so that the Germans, unless they sent an aircraft over, wouldn't be able to hear it, wouldn't be able to sort of detect it. And we had our Defiant aircraft up at Drem, and we tested it out. Now, the Germans very cleverly had their radars cover quite a wide frequency spectrum. I can't what it was now, but it was like, let's say it was from 110 to 130. Now, to cover that whole spectrum, we needed a lot of equipment, and it took three Defiants to carry all the equipment for the whole span of the frequencies. And so we had a little flight of three Defiants. And we had a very good time up in Drem with that team. There was at the time there were fighter squadrons that were resting. They used to come up and rest at Drem, and it was a very hard working period getting all this going. And there's one or two little minor stories about that. I remember we were working very hard, and there was we perhaps weren't as well dressed for dinner in the officer's mess as we should have been as civilians, and there was a note in the suggestions book of that officer's mess saying bringing to the attention of the mess